bearings were threatened. We will, in the weeks to come, reluctantly, of course, take up again the topic of how science is being challenged by those who don't know any. Oh, and if you're keeping score of Donald Trump's abilities as a weather forecaster, note the following chronology. September 2017, Category 5 Hurricane Irma evoked the following quote from Trump. Looks like it could be something that would not be good. September 2017, Category 5 Hurricane Maria, said Trump regarding Puerto Rico. This is an island surrounded by water, big water, ocean water. October 2018, Category 5 Hurricane Michael, Trump. It's like a big tornado, a massive tornado. September 2019, Category 5 Hurricane Dorian, said Trump. I'm not sure I've ever even heard of a Category 5. He's never heard of a Category 5 hurricane, and yet he believes he can plot its path. All right, that about does it for today's program, which was produced by Edward McMillan.
All righty. You are listening to Ask Dr. Gale, and this is KCHO 91.1 FM. And I'm really excited tonight we're having a show about women and non-traditional careers. And I'll introduce the panel in just a minute. Just so you can know, October 10th show is going to be about educational issues in Chico. And so we have the superintendent of schools, we have the school board head, we have a representative of a charter school, Chico Country Day, and I'm working to get a student body president because too often students get left out of discussion of their issues.
That was a problem. So first, let's thank our sponsors. Ask Dr. Gale is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, a safe local partner for the California Arts Council since 2001. Deborah Lucero, who, by the way, is our is in the supervisor position, and Friends of the Arts have been creating community festivals and events, including Oktoberfest. The True North Tour, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsoftheArts.upstate.org. And Ask Dr. Gale is also made possible by Live Life Juice Company, providing healthy, fresh, local, organic, cold-pressed juices. They're really good. And they have other food there, too, I can testify. And Elixirs, plus vegan and gluten-free organic food. The store is open weekdays from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. and on weekends from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. with delivery service available. Woohoo! More information is available at livelifejuice.com, or they have a Facebook and an Instagram page, or you can call their number, 566-3346. Live Life Juice Company, pure fresh juice. Drink to your health. Okay, so as I said, a panel tonight is talking about women in non-traditional careers, and we'll start with the first question of how did you get in your career, and we'll just go one by one. So, Dr. Kathleen Mahan, how did you come to be an engineer and chair of your department?
Well, I'll start with from a standpoint of high school. I was very involved in sciences, so I took every AP science course that we had and AP calculus. So at the time, I was leaning towards going into physics because most of the engineering schools didn't allow women or didn't accept women. So it was in the early or mid-1970s that engineering schools in general started opening up. And I happened to go to a career fair, and this guy that was recruiting for the undergraduate program that I ended up going to mentioned that they were accepting women for engineering. And it also at that point, I learned that most of the physics programs required that you know two foreign languages, and that was no way that I would be able to pass that. So I ended up going into engineering simply because of a conversation that I had at a career fair. So since then, I went straight from my undergraduate to graduate program, and then worked in industry at three different companies before going into academics. And strangely enough, this is my fifth university.
So where was this? What high school did you go to?
So I come from the Northeast. The high school that I went to is called Spackenkill High School in Poughkeepsie, New York. Oddly enough, I didn't really know much about engineering, even though that was a hotbed for IBM. On my block of the 60 houses, 59 of them had an IBMer in it. But it was very lucky because the high school that I went to had an amazing array of science courses. I took a programming course where we would actually, this is really old school, dial in on a modem to Sterling Forest, which was an IBM mainframe computer, and using a Diablo typewriter to communicate with the computer, make our programs, and then we'd get the results. So it was. I also took an electronics course as a junior, and so I had quite an array of science background before I went into college.
And where were you in college? Where did you go?
A small school in New York City called Manhattan College. It had 5,000 people, 4,000 of which commuted in, so it was very empty on the weekends. And after graduating in 1980, I moved to University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And after 6 months of being on a teaching assistantship, I ended up getting hired as a research engineer, research assistant, by Nicholas Holonyak, who's known for making the first LED and the first quantum laser, and so I got involved in designing semiconductor lasers way back when. So,
wow. Did you ever hear, oh, well, this is going to jeopardize your chance of catching a good man, a good provider kind of guy?
Not really. I mean, my mother was always interested in having everybody get married, but to be quite honest, there are a ton of guys in engineering, so it's not like it's hard to find. It's just you have to put up with the fact that they're engineers. So,
what does that mean?
There's a certain personality type that tends to get attracted into engineering, and they say, and believe me, I'm one of them, is that the social skills tend not to be quite as refined as with other people. Spelling tends to be really poor. And, you know, some arguments are that we develop great math and science skills because we compensate for the fact that we're not doing well in the English classes in elementary and high school.
How interesting.
Yeah. There's all sorts of other weird things, like we have more left-handed people in engineering, higher number of dyslexic people in engineering than the general population.
And what about being department chair? In the School of Engineering, I'm assuming that there's not very many women who are chairs.
Well, actually, the Dean, Melody Stapleton, was chair of the computer science department. The issue really is that, I mean, when I graduated with my bachelor's degree back in 1980, which, of course, is a long time ago, I was one of 10% women in electrical engineering. And unfortunately, at CSU Chico and several of the other schools I've been at, the current population of women in electrical engineering in those schools are about 10%.
As students?
Yeah. And nationally, it's up at about 18%. Some schools are very high. I can point to one, Duke University, where it's actually pushing closer to 40%, but the national average is really right below 20%. And there was a trend back in the 80s where it climbed, but the peak enrollment for females in electrical engineering peaked in 89 and dropped, and it hasn't recovered since then.
Why do you think that is? Why was 89 the crucial time, and why has it dropped?
There's a lot of speculation, but no one has a real definitive answer. Some of it could be the fact that at some point the emphasis in elementary school and high school was back to more letting you pick your career versus suggesting that you go into certain areas if you have strong math. You know, so when I was in school, I always knew I was never going to be an English teacher, so or anything that was like that. But, you know, when I took the aptitude test, I was told that I could either be a florist or a scientist. And I knew I wasn't going to be a florist because, you know, all I knew how to do was plant in straight lines, and they weren't really straight. So, so my artistic abilities weren't there. But I always knew I was going to be on the science side. But it's not common, I don't think, necessarily to direct women that are strong in science and mathematics into engineering per se, that there's a lot of other careers that you can go into that also now need the math and science background. And so the guidance counselors aren't just pushing engineering.
Mm. And last question for this segment, why did you pick electrical?
Well, computer engineering didn't exist, neither did bioengineering. So your choices back in the 80s were probably electrical, civil, mechanical, and sometimes chemical, depending on what school you were in. And I had taken an electronics class, I had taken a programming class in my senior and junior years, so I knew I liked that. So it was a natural fit for me to go into that area.
Mm-hmm. I'm writing a book about visionary scientists who are doing unusual research, and a lot of them who are physicists and engineers, as kids, they were really interested in taking things apart and putting things together. So they had that kind of, I want to know how things work, how I want to take this apart and see how the parts fit back together. So it was kind of part of their childhood.
Yeah, my mother has a favorite story. When I was two, I pulled down the German cuckoo clock that my father had brought back when he was in the army and took it apart, and my father could never put it back together again. But when we were kids, it wasn't a structured play. We would go into the backfield, dam up the creek that was running back there, and fish things out of the pond, and do all sorts of other weird things that kids don't seem to do too much these days.
Yeah, I'm just reading, this is a footnote, but I'm reading that the increasing anxiety and depression of teens, especially girls, is partly due to not having free time to explore, to make mistakes, to learn, and they're always hovered over, so you don't gain the confidence of, oh, I can problem solve. So I think it's such a blessing for those of us who had childhoods where we could roam and throw dirt clods and get poison oak and climb trees and stuff. So Marie Patterson is also an instructor at Chico State and teaches construction management. Do you have muscles? Did you?
I've been athletic all my life, so I do have some muscles, yes.
Okay. And how did you get into the field?
So I was very strong in math and sciences, but I was well-rounded. I was good in English. I took AP English in high school as well, but very strong math and sciences. I actually took pre-calc at Chico State my senior year in high school. My dad actually was a graduate of the industrial technology program, which has since kind of been modified into the mechanical engineering sustainable manufacturing program, but So my dad was a graduate, and I was always the girl that was out in the shop with my dad and the tomboy. So for me, it was natural, and I initially went into civil engineering. And after participating with a few things in the civil engineering department, I noticed that there was a construction management class that seemed a little bit more interesting because I enjoyed being out in the field and I didn't necessarily always want to be behind a computer designing things. So I ended up taking that class, fell in love with the students in the construction management department and the faculty, and so ended up changing majors then to construction management. After I had graduated, I went to work for a mechanical construction company in the Bay Area for about 10 years.
Did you have a specialty in construction management, like they have concrete or this?
Yeah, so my background or my expertise in college was actually heavy civil construction. So I had worked for, I'd done internships with two of the largest heavy civil national contractors, Kiewit and Granite.
Does heavy mean like bridges and big buildings?
Bridges, roadways. Yep. So Kiewit, for instance, is the contractor that's repairing the spillway at the Orville Dam. And Granite, I had done an internship in Salt Lake City, Utah, widening the freeways in and out of Park City prior to the Winter Olympics. So I was on a paving crew and working out in a job site for the summer. But I ended up being recruited and going to work for a specialty mechanical construction contractor that did a lot of high purity process piping work, a lot of pharmaceutical, microelectronics, a very technical pharmaceutical and high purity stainless steel and other piping projects. So I worked for them for 10 years. I came back to Chico State. I got a job in the facilities department and actually worked on campus, ultimately becoming energy and sustainability manager at the facilities department. So I managed the utility budget. I was in charge of all of the energy retrofit projects on campus. I even managed the design department that managed all of the minor capital construction on campus for an interim basis. I got lured back by industry and for the money, and then worked for a large pharmaceutical company, Gilead, in their facilities department, managing their lab renovation projects at their corporate headquarters in Foster City. Was there for a year and then ended up going back to work for a mechanical construction firm, working on large pharmaceutical projects down at Genentech Oceanside, and then ultimately managing the sales and estimating departments of Northern California. And then I'd always stayed in very close communication. I'm an alma mater of the Chico State CM department, and they called me saying that there was a full-time position, a tenure-track position that had been opened, and they encouraged me to apply. And so last August, I started teaching.
So your work isn't like hammer and nail framing houses. So you haven't been out in the field so much as designing and overseeing, administrating construction?
No. So working for a mechanical construction, we're working with the plumbers, pipe fitters, steam fitters. We're working with the HVAC technicians. So it's just a different type of construction. And we did a lot of healthcare and, like I said, very high purity. So, if you go walk by the window at Sierra Nevada Brewery, that side, that type of more on the manufacturing side of thing, not so much on the commercial or residential side of standard plumbing or HVAC.
Mm-hmm. So you had to have strong math and accounting kind of skills to do all this budgeting and
design. In construction management, we do have to take accounting classes, business classes, communication classes. We do take one semester of calculus, two semesters of physics. So it's a very well-rounded major to where we have to learn the business side and the technical side of construction.
If your father hadn't been so supportive, do you think you would have done this kind of work?
Yes.
There's a study that that firstborn daughters get a lot of attention from their fathers. Were you a firstborn?
I have an older half-sister, but I was my dad's firstborn, yes.
And so then in these studies, the father treats the firstborn girl like his buddy, and he's proud of her, and and maybe not even as supportive of his wife, but the daughter gets the approval and the incentive to go ahead and achieve. It's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know if that was necessarily the dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
As a child, I was equally strong-willed, and so my mom has a story where she said she knew when I was about 4 years old that she was never going to be able to offer or make a suggestion for me because I was just going to do what I wanted to do anyway. Hello. So I don't know if how much my parents necessarily influenced. I'm sure they did, but ultimately most of the decisions in my life have been based on what I've chosen to do.
How interesting. Okay, so Abby Flender is a firefighter, and tell us how you came to that profession.
All right. Well, mine started when I was young, back in high school. I was actually at Chico High, and it was September 11th, so very fitting that it we're here today, the day after.
Mm.
It didn't happen while I was in high school. I was a little bit younger, but we were watching a memorial documentary that was done by some French filmmakers, and I highly recommend you look it up. It's really pretty great. So these French filmmakers came over, and they actually just wanted to document the day in the life of a FDNY firefighter. So the documentary starts out, and it's following a guy who is on the floor working as a firefighter, and he's just talking about how every day it's his job to prepare himself and his crew and his rig and everything on it, all the tools, and just make sure that they're emergency ready. So he's starting the chainsaws, and he's pulling out the rig, and he's checking the lights on it. He's making sure the siren room works, and he's just talking about how important it is to always be ready for anything, because they encounter anything at any given moment, and they have to be prepared to handle it and problem solve, which I've always been a huge believer that learning how to problem solve and kind of stay calm in the moment is really one of the best skills you can learn and have as a person. So I thought that was pretty unique. However, the documentary obviously takes a turn, because the second day of filming was September 11th, 2001. So wow. A lot of those chilling images that you see of the planes hitting the towers and them crashing and everything were actually done by the professional film crew responding in with some of those first responders of FDNY. So very powerful, great documentary. And I watched that as, I think I was a junior. I might have been a senior in high school. And it was just kind of a remembrance day. And it was in my government econ class. And that kind of got my wheels turning, like, oh, what a unique career. You have to be ready for anything, and every single day is different. And it doesn't, you know, it's very routine based. You know, we start out the day and we check out all of our rigs and we make sure everything's ready to go. And then we go and participate in training, and then we, you know, like go and do community involvement. And there's so many different things that we have to do throughout the day. However, at any given moment, all of that gets pushed aside so that we can go and serve the community and serve the public and use our skills and use our training. And I just love that.
What about the strength factor? Because you have to be able to lift a heavy hose full of water, right?
Yes.
How does that factor
in? So conversely to the two women who spoke before me, I was not super involved in school. I was not very educationally inclined. I was there more for the social aspect and enjoyed sports, and that was really my main primary focus, and playing sports and being on a team and, you know, going to all the extracurricular activities. I loved doing all of that, and I think that carries over perfectly into the fire department, because we are a team. We function as a team. We work as a little unit together all the time, with a captain and an engineer who's a driver, and myself who's a firefighter, and we function as a little crew and work together and pretty much handle almost anything that can be thrown at us, with requesting for help when needed and adding on to it with more crews and more resources as necessary. But it works so well if you're into sports, and if you're into being a team player, and if you're into being physically strong. As a female of somewhat smaller stature, I've always enjoyed working out and lifting weights and being strong and taking a lot of pride in that. So it went hand in hand with following through with this career, because it gave me even more motivation throughout the last 10 plus years of my life that I've been doing this, that it gave me more motivation when I'm feeling a little lazy and I don't really want to work out. It's like, well, no, I need to, because I have to do this job. So I have to stay strong and I have to stay in shape and I have to make sure that I'm always ready for not only myself and my own safety, but my crew's safety and then the safety of the public.
So how what kind of heft does it take to lift a hose full of water? What do you have to be able to press to manage that?
I would say it's more an overall being able to use your body and use your body well. Mm. So being able to kind of just overall athletically knowing how to move and how to stay safe, because injuries are a huge portion of what make this job so difficult and difficult to keep and maintain a 30-year-plus-year career, because injuries happen so frequently and they take people out. And that is actually why I continued and went on with college, because you're just one bad day, one bad injury away from needing a new career. However, having an overall skill of fitness and sports and kind of knowing how to, you know, like a power clean is a movement where you use your hips and your back and your arms and your whole body to kind of generate power from the ground up. You press really hard with your legs and you're able to move weight from the ground to your shoulders. And so using that same sort of technique, being able to throw ladders and move hose lines around, it's kind of being able to use your body well and generate power.
So you're moving smart.
Yes.
Kind of like a martial artist or something.
Yes, yeah.
So it's not just brute strength.
Yes.
It's brains. And are you an EMT as well?
Yes. Everyone in my department is EMT certified.
And how do you like that part of the job? What percent of the job is doing that kind of health care?
So for us with Chico Fire Department, I don't know if I mentioned that, but I've been with Chico Fire Department for 5 years, and it's been amazing to work here in my hometown for the city department. Dream job. So for us, we actually, the last numbers were right around 62% to 64% of medical aids, and then the remainder were fire response and all emergency hazards, including hazmat and rescue incidents and traffic collisions and things of that nature. So you can see the majority of it is the medical side. And so it's very important to kind of know those medical skills. And let me tell you, when I got into the fire academy, I was not excited about the medical side of it. I just wanted to be super strong and fast and run into burning buildings and get that adrenaline.
Yeah,
rescue people and pull them out and be a savior and a hero and adrenaline junkie, all that stuff. But the more that I learned about the medical side, the more that I actually really enjoyed it. And knowing and understanding how the human body works, and that actually, with my EMT experience from the fire academy, it pushed me into pursuing a bachelor's degree in exercise physiology that I continued and got through Chico State.
Mm-hmm. What about you spend 24, 48 hours at a time on a shift in the fire station? How does your husband like that?
That's a good question. I'm sure he'd be happy to tell you. No, my husband's great. He's super supportive, and I'm so fortunate to have someone like him who's by my side and supportive and totally okay with me living in a frat house a couple days a week. So our shifts currently for Chico Fire, other fire departments are different, but our shifts are 2 days on, so 48 hours straight, and then we have 4 days off. And so in those 48 hours, if any sort of call to service arises within our district or within the city that we need to respond to, we'll go to that. So it doesn't matter, you know, we do have beds and get to go to sleep at night. However, if there's an emergency that takes all night long, then that means we still have to be up and ready to work the next day and respond to everything. So usually when the students get back, it gets really busy and we don't get a lot of sleep. Mm. But it's fun, and it's a completely different atmosphere than a lot of other offices. We, you know, kind of joke about that. I'm lucky enough where I actually get to drive the back portion of the tiller truck that we have around town. So I just talk about loving my office because I get to sit back there. I have a great view and weave through traffic and drive code 3 with lights and sirens behind my engineer. And yeah, it's fun.
Talk about adrenaline.
Yeah.
This is a silly question, but when I've looked at fire stations and I see all those beds in a row, I think, what do you do about snorers?
You shame them.
What can they do?
It's just kind of a part of the job, and we've all accepted it. And some people, you know, when they're more tired than normal, and sometimes they'll go over to the other side and sleep in a recliner or on a couch in the classroom. And that's honestly why we have those, is you separate the beds and the couches from sometimes the sleeping area. So
earplugs, I don't know if they were. If you're just joining us, this is KZFR 90.1 FM, and you're listening to Ask Dr. Gail, and we're talking with a panel of brilliant women in non-traditional careers, and the October 10th show is going to be about educational issues, and we have the superintendent of schools, the head of the school board, I'm a representative of a charter school, Chico Country Day, and hopefully a student body president, because I hate it when people talk about educational issues and youth issues and don't include youth, which is usually what happens, as I explained in my book, Ageism and Youth Studies. Okay, so now we turn to Abigail Madden, who's a captain in the Chico PD, and how did you get there? You're not
actually
a captain? Did I promote you?
No, yeah, you gave me quite a field promotion there. I'm not sure I want to accept that. I'm a police officer.
Mm.
I've been a police officer with the city of Chico for a little bit more than 25 years. I'm sorry, I guess I missed the first part of the question.
What made you decide to become a police officer?
Well,
not accepting my promotion, I'm sorry.
Exactly. Well, I grew up, I actually grew up in Oroville. I was born and raised in Oroville, just 20 miles south of here. And my father was a police officer in Oroville for about 30 years. And a lot of people think that I became a police officer because of Dad.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually had nothing to do with my father. That was Dad's job. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. That was just a means to an end. In fact, I didn't even really care for it that much because of his job. That meant that he wasn't always there on Christmas morning or Thanksgiving dinner and things like that. I don't want to say I was just a tomboy. I was in everything. I mean, I played with dolls and Barbies and, I also jumped off a roof with a patio umbrella. I was every end of the spectrum, just kind of this feral child. Quite the athlete, went to high school. I really did like school and learning, bookworm, most sciences. Math, other than geometry, was a bit challenging for me. You just made me think of some things now that I did in high school, and I'm like, oh, should I confess that to that, teacher? I was the one that, when I was in high school, computers were just, and computer science was just coming on, and they used to make us do busy work, and that used to drive me crazy, busy work. Teach me how to do something, and there was a class before us, before my class, and same class. And you had to do this busy work and do these, like, definitions and then save them. And I figured out a way to hack into the class's documents before us. And so they would have saved their half of their assignment. And so what my class did, then we just completed the assignment and saved it all back for everybody. I'm really sorry, Mr. Computer Science Instructor.
But it was teamwork.
It was me.
It was teamwork.
But I went to high school, I went through high school, always an athlete, loved volleyball. Volleyball was my thing. Went to college, played volleyball in college, and a lot like Abby here next to me, was into the social aspect and the team aspect of it. And, having a little bit of freedom when you get out your first year of college, this is great. Until, when you're in school and you're an athlete, you have to have so many units before you can play in your second semester. And because of my social tendencies, I was looking like I might not be able to play in that second semester. And so here I am panicking. And I'm not a bad student, but I really...
You were distracted.
Distracted. I need to be wanting to learn that thing. So a friend of mine said, hey, take this Introduction to Criminal Justice class. The teacher is very dynamic. It's 4 units. It's just it's a great class. You're really going to like it. And that's what I needed. And I went there and I took that and I was like, wow, I like this because it's got science and it's got talking to people and it's different and it's got like puzzles figuring it out. And there we went. So from there on, I started.
Was that at Chico State?
Butte College in Chico State. And so there I went from there on and began testing for different departments. I actually worked for the probation department for a little while, started out working in juvenile hall while I was testing for to become a police officer. And, you know, when I tested for Chico PD, they still had a lottery to see who could test.
Oh.
And we had more than 300 applicants. That was all they could take. And they used to take that written test and do it over at Chico State. And that was the first thing you did. You got accepted, your application. You went and you took the written test. And after the written test, they took the top so many. And then you went and you did your physical test. Well, when I did my written, I came out number 2. And after the physical test, I blew that other gal out the door. So...
There are only two women who are...
No. There were other women, but she was the only one ahead of me scoring-wise.
Oh.
So, and there were other men that tested faster than me through the physical agility, but they were still behind me in the written. So I was still number 1. And that was kind of cool. Up until we changed the physical agility test, I held the record for all females.
Oh,
and they changed it. So I still don't know. Like I said, I've been there for, 25 plus years. I've held different positions. I was in the Detective Bureau for 6 years with a focus on crimes against persons. So, homicide, assaults, child abuse, child molest, sexual assault, a field training officer, crime scene investigator, defensive tactics instructor. I was a member of the mounted unit when we had that. So it's really been a very broad career. I'm very, very fortunate to have had that. And it's kind of interesting. I talked to a friend a couple of years ago that I hadn't seen, a childhood friend, and she said, I always knew you'd be a cop. You were always the cop when we were kids. And I was like, and she's not talking about cops and robbers. She's talking about the one who settled everything and made, okay, you stop this and you stop that. And standing in front of the one who might get bullied and saying, well, you got to come through me first. And I have a very pronounced chin, and apparently I tend to stick it out a lot, like go ahead and give that one a tap. But that's where I am, and that's where I've stayed.
And you do EFT as well, right? The medical kind of work as well.
We are not. Police officers are not EMTs. We have a better, higher first aid training than your lay citizen. First aid, CPR, things like that, because sometimes we are the first ones on scene. Years ago, I was the first one on scene for a baby that wasn't breathing.
I read
so,
about that. I read about all of you, but you saved the blue baby.
Yeah, that one, I saved the blue baby and probably tore the transmission out of the SUV that I was driving, throwing it into park so fast, but that was... they give you a pass on that when you save the baby. So,
how do you protect yourself, especially with child abuse? It's so wrenching. And so if you're seeing those kind of cases, seeing face to face with people day after day, how do you keep from going home and going, I hate humanity, I can't stand this, I'm depressed, or whatever your reaction would be?
Well, and that's it. You do those things. And that's ugly. I mean, that's the ugly blackness of our job. You know, that's one of the things that I tell people when they say, oh, you get to retire at 50? You're so lucky. I wish I could do that. Why do you get to do that? And I say, how many dead babies have you seen? And that's harsh, but it usually shuts them up real quick because
sure.
You just can't. That is a very black part of it. And you see some of it, you know, they people watch TV shows, and even now they have live PD, which captures some of that blackness sometimes. But they really don't get in there with some of the heinous things that we experience that people will do to other people, and especially children. That's my thing that'll make me flash red. Make me, you know, that'll make me start to twitch a little bit and start thinking about, okay, I could go to prison. And then you have to back it off. And you really do. You have to step back and say, this is not the best way for me to handle this. I have to go. I have to calm down. I have to talk to somebody. I have to go and sit in my garden and look at what is beautiful in this world. I do. I like to garden. I have way too many hobbies, way too many. Ask anybody that knows me. You know, and I also have horses and some other pets. And I look at that and, you know, it's like last night, one of my mules, she just came up and walked up behind me and stuck her head over my shoulder and just kind of like, hey, pay attention to me for a minute. Oh. I would like some snuggles. And it's those things that help balance you out. And we all have, those are my balance points. Some other people have other balance points. You know, maybe to get rid of it for the moment, get rid of that stress for the moment. You know, I got to go work out. I got to go run. I got to drain myself right now. If you're going to be successful in law enforcement and have that sort of a well-rounded career where you're dealing with all those different things, you have to have some sort of outlet and something to keep you balanced. And it doesn't matter if it's your pets, your garden, your church, your friends, your family, or a whole bunch of the other. You have to have that or you will fail.
You'd be overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Were you... Kathleen, an athlete is a girl as well, because I'm looking for patterns. And so these three were athletic, maybe tomboys, not shy little violets. Does that fit for you too in terms of a pattern?
I don't think anybody call me a shy little violet. So, I mean, the neighborhood that I grew up in, actually was skewed a little bit more towards boys than it was girls. So I did play kickball with the guys. I learned how to play baseball rather than softball, things like that. But when I got into high school, I had a outside job, and so that pretty much stopped any athletic. And, you know, to be quite honest, you know, I was taking usually... in my junior and senior year, sort of two AP classes at a time. So it was just a juggle to do the working 20 to 30 hours a week and the coursework.
I think the idea is that sports teach people to be team players, which you need to be successful in a career, especially with one that's probably male-dominated, and to be able to handle the joking, the put-downs, the... dominance struggles and posturing and all that kind of thing. So having an athletic background that you all had was a preparation to handle yourself in a male dominated career.
Well, plus I was usually the captain, you know, so it was not just team playing, it was also, you know, rounding everybody up to have
team leading.
Yes. Yeah.
What was your birth order?
I'm first, but and then we had two other girls before me.
And first, what was your
first
birth?
And I'm a Leo. So that
doesn't yeah.
Oh, congratulations. So am I.
Leo, first. Okay. Well.
Middle.
And what's your sign?
Pisces, Aries.
The Aries is what kicked in. What's your birth?
First and a Capricorn.
My visionary scientists are mostly firstborn. There's a book that says no, rebel scientists are usually later born because they're less conforming. So maybe that's where you fit in, less conforming. I don't know. We want to let people know you're listening to KCFR Radio 90.1, and we want to thank our generous contributors, KCFR supporters. The C and A cleaning, serving Chico, Paradise, Durham, and Oroville. I forgot my glasses, sorry. Since 1989. And they're branded and insured. C&A Cleaning handles residential, commercial, and restaurant cleaning services. They use environmentally friendly cleaning services, thank goodness. And when you need it done right, call C&A Cleaning at 514-7738. And you can find them online. And Ask Dr. Gale is also brought to you by the Handlebar. And they offer 28 taps of craft beer. Well, that's a lot of different kinds of beer. This is a German-inspired pub, and they have food as well, an outdoor patio on 20th Street in Chico next to Winco. They're open weekdays from 11 a.m. Do we start drinking beer at 11 a.m.? My goodness. Until 10 p.m. and at midnight on the weekends. The Handlebar is a specialty beer bar for the adventurer. You can find food at the Handlebar and find information about them on Facebook, or you can call 894-BEER for more information. So what I wanted to ask you next is, does it make a difference to have women in your field? Like, Ms. Madden, there's kind of a stereotype that women police officers don't use brute force, they don't escalate conflict, they calm things down, they get people to communicate and take a breath. Is that a stereotype? Is it true? Is it not true?
Well, it all depends on, I guess, who you're talking to. You know, the biggest ones to stereotype law enforcement officers or society, not the officers themselves. So, you know, I can come on a scene and probably calm some things down, but I know I sure have escalated things a few times as well. But I don't think that as a whole, I know as a whole that our department, the other officers, the male officers, or even the female officers think, oh, we need to get a female there to calm things down. Mm. You just, it just tends to be that you have some folks that are better at mitigating and mediating than others. It might be that folks think that, but I think that's society that thinks that, not actual law enforcement.
How many women are on the police force now besides you?
Okay. I memorized this number, so I'm going to have to count on my... Okay.
Someone said that they hired 4 new women police officers.
No, that's incorrect. We do have 3 that are in the training program now. That's not so astounding. That it's not, you know, they just happen to be the ones that applied. I know we've had 3 at a time before, but let's see. So there's Sophia, Jamae, Jamie. Oh. Lauren, Miranda, Marissa,
Lindsay,
and Victoria. So that's 9 of us.
Out of how many?
Out of the sworn personnel, I think we have 105 sworn. So you're almost at 10%.
So people really notice you.
I was going to say, so that's not 105, that's not all street cops. So that's sworn personnel. So that goes from the chief down. So if you're talking about just street cops that you see on patrol, that's actually more than 10%.
Mm.
So there's only 70 or so of those.
So... it really doesn't make a difference if someone is male or female in terms of their influence on the job.
Well, that's a tough one. That really is a tough one because I have worked, you know, I've been there for 25 years, so I've seen a lot of change.
Mm.
I remember being there when there was one officer, another female officer, and she says, I can't wait until we have an all-female shift. And I well, I don't really want an all-female shift because, let's face it, men are just plain stronger than women. And sometimes I need man muscles, okay? And so I'd like that person to be there. I get what she was saying, but in reality, that's probably not something, you know, 50-50, something like that is great. But I just want the person that can do the job the best. You know, I want them to show up on their calls. I want them to handle their calls for service within policy, within the law, and do the right human thing. I don't care if you're male, female, or purple. Just let's get here, get stuff done, and let's all go home safe.
What studies show is that businesses that have, like, mixed boards or mixed heads of the business do better. There's you get access to information that you don't get if it's all one or the other. So, Abby, why don't you take that one? What do you think, it makes a difference or not that to have a woman firefighter?
As a female firefighter, as far as making a difference on the job of being a woman or not, I would say that just dealing with people, and it's people's own perception, kind of what Abby was saying, that it's people's own perception, where sometimes we respond to someone who, you know, maybe went through a rape or something really traumatic, or went through a car accident and she's really shook up, and, you know, and so they just respond better to a female presence rather than to a male presence. And it's nothing to do with saying, you know, it makes a huge difference if I'm there or not, because either way the job's going to get done. But sometimes people respond better or different. And contrary to that, I've had some old men say, I need a man to lift me up. And so, you know, you just kind of shrug it off and go, well, this is what you got. You called 911, and I'm the one who showed up.
And I can lift you.
Yeah, it's like, well, you know,
because
I'm almost 200 pounds. I said, well, that sounds like a personal problem. We can work on that for next time. You know, and so it's just a matter of, you know, it's like we're a team, and if there is something that's really, you know, if someone's really adamant of feeling like I don't fit the mold, then, you know, that's really kind of on the person who called 911. But honestly, in a lot of our opinion,
I'm pleading to death, could you bring me a man quick?
Yeah, in a lot of our opinion, if they're feeling that critical, it's not really a true emergency. So most of the time, if it's a real emergency, life and death situation, a house burning down, they don't care.
Right.
They don't care. They just want someone's help, anyone's help that's going to help make it better. And that's why I love the job. I love being able to help make it better. In someone's darkest moment, you show up and you do everything you can to make it better. So as far as being a woman or a man, once again, it's just kind of being capable and able to do the job. And we get tested a lot when we first get hired to make sure that we're able to.
In the early days when women first started being firefighters, I'd read all accounts, like the other firefighters put feces in her boots, or there, you know, there were, or pin-up pictures in her locker with gross stuff. So I'm assuming that kind of harassment is in the past.
Yes, and I am incredibly thankful for all the women who paved the way to get me to be where I am and be in a completely comfortable, healthy environment, because, man, they have some thick skin. That it's definitely, it's a boys club, but I mean, they're just like society today, where we try and be more open-minded and try and be more accepting, and most people that I've worked with have been great and been super supportive and been very helpful and encouraging. So the women who first started out in the fire service, it's I could only imagine would be quite tough, and I am forever in their debt, because I love my career, but I don't know if I could hack it if I were in their shoes.
One of the things that's really hard for me is sometimes men have a humor that's put down, and they're like laughing. And if someone said those things about me, I would be in tears. I mean, they could really get to your sore spot or something. So has that changed in the fraternity, or is it still that kind of put down humor and dominance?
Oh,
struggles?
We're incredibly cruel to one another. Very, very cruel to, and it's kind of one of those things where you don't want to show any bit of that pink underbelly, because as soon as it's exposed, they'll start poking it. And so it's you know, we're a pretty cohesive little family, and sometimes you don't get along with your family, but for the most part it's a pretty good understanding of where that line is. And there's certain individuals where you know exactly what triggers them, and some people choose to do that, and some people know that it's too far. So,
so how many firefighters are there in Chico Fire?
There's 51 of us.
Out of
floor personnel.
Wait, how many are women?
Three, including myself.
And does that bother anybody that we should do a little more recruiting or that kind of thing?
So the fire service is, it's so highly competitive for jobs, and it's so, just as an example, the picture that I like to paint was when I got picked up with Chico 5 years ago, it was advertised as a 2-year grant position. So that meant that I would only work here. I would work my butt off for 2 years and then be laid off because we'd run out of money for the grant. And that was the position that was available. And within, I think it was 3 hours, all 1,000 applications had been filled up.
Whoa.
So many people wanted to simply work here for just 2 years and then get laid off.
Right.
So thankfully, through attrition and through some other things, most of us were able to keep our jobs. We did have to go through a round of layoffs, but it's such a desirable job. And there's so many steps that Abby kind of alluded to. As a police officer, it's very similar for a firefighter. And so you have to do your time and pass your resume around, and you do several rounds of interviews, and you do a physical agility course, and you do a physical examination with a doctor, and you do a psychological evaluation. Mm. And there's so many different things that by the time you come out, honestly, it kind of works in your favor during the recruiting process to be a female, just simply because it makes you memorable.
Yeah.
Because when you have, you know, 1,000 people all wanting the job and only 22 of them are women, you kind of have a better chance of being remembered. However, once that recruiting process is over and it's time to do the work and get the job done, you also kind of stick out a little bit. So you got to make sure that you're able to do the job, and everybody wants to test you and make sure that you can handle it. So it works both ways, but I think that I'm fortunate enough to work in a department where it's very supportive, and it's fun to be at work with my coworkers personally.
That's great.
Yeah.
Ms. Patterson, what about the role for women in construction management? How many faculty are there that are female in the department?
So there's technically 3 faculty in the department now. One is a faculty who was there, got hired when I was a student, so she's in the process of retiring.
Mm.
There's myself that's on the tenure track, and we have one other lecturer.
And roughly what percent of the students are female?
We're just above 9%. So construction industry average is just around 10%, so we're currently at industry average.
It seems to me that most people probably think of construction as hammer and nails, and what you've let us know is that, no, you can be in construction management and be a manager and a designer and a budget person. So what are you doing, what's the department doing to recruit more women? And I'm assuming people of color.
Yeah, so we are going through a phase right now where we are trying to do more outreach within the department. So just last spring, myself and other students actually created a Chico State Women in Construction student chapter. So we've sent out fundraising letters. In a matter of a month, we've raised $16,000 or $17,000.
Oh, wow.
So we have an opportunity to do several events and hopefully try to spread the word. I've submitted a grant application to do some outreach with some high school students in Shasta County to encourage women to come into construction, where there is a demand for skilled trades, which there's a just overall shortage of skilled trades, both from men and obviously from women. The percentage of women in skilled trades is significantly lower than overall in construction, and it's a great career field. So, I mean, managing construction is a legitimate career, and a lot of people do default, oh, that's construction. I didn't even know there was a construction management department until I got to Chico State, and Chico State has one of the first construction management departments that was created in the U.S. Mm. It's been around since 78.
Oh, wow.
So, even just knowing that that's an option and you can make very good money starting out of school, going to work in the Bay Area, starting salary for a lot of our students is $65,000, $70,000 in the Bay Area. And you don't hear about that. So it's generally higher, maybe not not quite computer science, but it's higher than a lot of the other even College of Engineering majors, and we have 100% placement rate. So there's no reason why anybody should be deterred from working as a construction manager.
Right. And so listeners will know, this is being videotaped, and I put it on my YouTube channel. So if you want to turn young women on to any of these fields, say, look, there's a woman firefighter. Mm-hmm. Let's close with you, Dr. Meehan. What